Would you join me in a word of prayer? Lord, gracious Lord, we pray that we would be reminded again and again, even in this moment, of just how beautiful you are, how good you are. Lord, I pray for any of us who have walked through these doors carrying all kinds of heavy loads of anxiety, depression. Lord, whatever it is we've brought through these doors with us, we ask, Jesus, that you would meet us and that you would reveal to us again and again why all of the first followers referred to meeting you as good news. And so, Jesus, we love you, we trust you, and we pray this in your name. And everybody said, amen. You may have a seat. How y'all doing? How are the rest of you doing? If I haven't met you yet, my name is Tim, and we're, like we've said a couple times now, we're really, really glad you joined us this morning. If you have a Bible, we are going to turn once again to Matthew chapter 5. We'll start there and then kind of end there, but and then in the middle, I want to show you a story that has been working on me now for about 4 years out of 1 Kings 10. And so, interesting story. We'll go there in just a few minutes, but we'll start in Matthew chapter 5, so it'd be a good place to turn. We are, if you're joining us for the first time, we're in the middle of a series, so kind of smack dab in the middle of a series that we called The Upside Down, looking at the way Jesus taught and the way Jesus lived and how counterintuitive it is even for us today. Like even now, it feels upside down. What Jesus was saying is, no, this is actually the right side up. Like this is the best way to live. And yet, even in our world today, it feels like, okay, that seems radical. Specifically, we've been looking at the introduction to Jesus' most famous sermon. That sermon's called the Sermon on the Mount. The introduction is a series of blessing statements, a series of statements of blessing called, we often refer to as the Beatitudes. Now, I want to pick up where we left off last week, and Last week we said that there are two voices we should always be listening to whenever it is we come to the Bible. The first is we should always be listening to the personal voice of Jesus to us. This is especially true when life is falling apart and when your heart is breaking. We have to be listening for Jesus saying, I love you, I care for you. Like a shepherd, I come to you and I protect you. So there's the personal voice. Then there's also the political voice. And this one's easier for us to tune out at times. When I say political, by the way, I don't mean like American politics necessarily. What I mean is Jesus would often take stands that pushed against systems and powers, and Jesus often took difficult positions. It's the reason why the religious people, the political people, and the wealthy people conspired to have him killed. Because Jesus would often, the personal, like if you're scared, here, come to me. But then it was, oh, and by the way, if you're the people that are keeping people scared, no, you're poor. Here, come, let me feed you. Let me take care of you. Oh, and by the way, if you're the system that's keeping people poor, stop it. You get both sides of this? Like Jesus wasn't just interested in just talking about the personal. It was always about, is there a system? Is there an institution? Is there a thing behind this thing that's kind of animating or fueling it? Make sense? So if you missed last week, we kind of got the ball rolling. This week, I want to dive into the deep end on that conversation. Let me name this on the front end. What I think is possible for us to do, and let's just think about like the personal voice of Jesus. When life is going well, it is possible that we don't actually hear, even though Jesus is still speaking, when life is going well, we often don't think to ask God to speak into our lives. Right? So it's possible that when life is going well, we don't actually hear the voice of Jesus that clearly. And then when life kind of like it gets difficult, we start listening for the very personal voice of Jesus. And we often hear the voice of Jesus because he's speaking. And we hear the voice of Jesus, the very personal voice of Jesus when life is not going well. When it comes to the political, the same is true. For those who are on the underside of power, the underside of privilege, they read the scriptures and they see this Jesus who's giving voice to the voiceless, power to the, like, to those who have lost all power. But to those who have power and privilege, it's pretty easy for us to say, oh no, we don't talk about politics in church. Really? Like, it's because Jesus did it all the time. So that's what that's where we're going a little bit this morning. I want to do a little bit of a Bible study with you all. Like I got to show you this story because I think if we can capture this story, it'll help. I find it to be one of those stories that is almost too relevant, if that makes sense. Like it's almost like you read the story and it's like, wait a minute, who's reading our news stories? Like it's one of those stories. So we're gonna look at that story, and then after that, I want to share with you some statistics that for me are game changers that pull this story into our world. So just some statistics about us today, and everyone will be tense in that moment, mostly myself, but we'll get through it, I promise. But let's start with the audience. I think it's really important in the Beatitudes, when reading the Beatitudes, these statements of blessing, to not just focus on what Jesus says, but also to have in our mind who Jesus sees when he's saying what he says. So a chapter earlier, in chapter 4, we read this. It says, Jesus went throughout Galilee, the region he lived and did his ministry, went throughout Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness among the people. News about him spread all over Syria, and people brought to him all who were ill with various diseases, those suffering severe pain, the demon-possessed, those having seizures, and the paralyzed, and he healed them. Large crowds from Galilee, the Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and the region across the Jordan followed him. Okay, so this is the crowd. When you think about the Sermon on the Mount, you have to picture desperate people. And Jesus says this to them. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. And we worked through those the last couple of weeks. And then this one today. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. These are the people Jesus is looking at. Jesus is looking at people who are, the word he uses is hungry for change. Like this thing is just not working for us. It's not right. Whatever is going on here, this is just not right. Jesus is talking to people who have been kicked down, pushed down, shoved down again and again and again. The empire of the day was a group of people known as the Romans. And the Romans, if you were a Roman, were quite good to you. But if you were not a Roman, if you were, say, from Galilee, the Romans were brutal. And so Jesus has a crowd of people who are desperate, and he says, blessed are you. You see, the thing is, we have a moral compass, all of us, right? Unless you're a sociopath, which is what, 4% or something they're saying. But so like 4, 8 of you. Crazy. But the rest of you, we have a moral compass. And this moral compass, like, we know right from wrong, and we can distinguish right from wrong. And often we get bogged down in our American politics, where we think that there's two sides, and both sides are arguing for one side's right and one side's wrong. But when you take like a step back, what you discover is we may disagree with policy, and that matters. Like, whoever is creating policy, very big job, well above my pay grade. But we may disagree with policy, but I mean, we have a moral compass. You see a shooting happen in a school, and all of us agree that that is wrong. There's no one saying that that's right. Now, we may disagree with like which kind of like law should be placed on guns, if there should be laws, but we see the news and we say, well, that's not how it's supposed to be. It isn't right. A couple years ago, that image of the boy, the refugee leaving a crisis washed up on shore, it broke all of us. Now, we could disagree on the policies around that, but that image broke all of us because we have a moral compass. You see some of those images of ISIS soldiers with weapons over pregnant women, and all of us feel it. It isn't right. It isn't right. It isn't right. And Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, is looking at a group of people, and it isn't right. What the Romans have done to us, Jesus, it isn't right. And Jesus sees them. I love the image of Jesus. It says he sits down. So Jesus gets at their level. Because when somebody's been pushed down again and again, you've watched, you kind of try to shrink into your own body. And so Jesus gets down and he looks at them. The people who are just tired, like you've been on the Sea of Galilee, you're fishermen, and you just want to bring some food home to feed your family. And so you've been fishing and fishing and fishing and fishing, and the catch is not good. And so you're pulling 18-hour days. There's a story where Peter's out in the middle of the night fishing. Like you're still up in the middle of the night trying to catch some fish. And finally, at the end of the day, you have your group of fish. And as you're walking home to feed your family, maybe the first time they've eaten today, to feed your family, a tax collector with gold jewelry backed with a Roman soldier says, "Give them to me." It isn't right, Jesus. It isn't right what they're doing to us. It isn't right what they're doing to us. It's not right. It isn't right. It's not the way it's supposed to be. It isn't right that you, how do you explain this to your kids? Kids, we can't take the road we always take past grandma and grandpa's house. Why, daddy? Why, mommy? You'll understand someday. Now, you know the reason, because the Romans have just walked down that road and grandma and grandpa didn't make it. How do you explain that to your kids? One of the things Romans love to do is they love to come into a territory and they like to claim that territory. By the backing of the Roman military, they would allow you to just walk into a house and say, you know what? I want this house. I want to take this property. That isn't right. What do you say? What do you say when somebody comes into your house and they say, it's ours now? It's not just a plot of land, you realize, right? Like I taught my son how to walk on that road right there. And my daughter, she said her first words in that room over there. This land has been passed down from my grandparents and their grandparents and their grandparents generations back. You can't just come in and take it. And this is the crowd. So when you think about the Sermon on the Mount, picture these people, the margins of society, the pushed down ones, the hurt ones, the stepped down ones. And Jesus comes to them and says, I see how hungry you are for this thing to be made right. You'll be filled. Jesus comes and he has a message of hope. Jesus says, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Now that word righteousness is a loaded word in the scriptures. Behind that word is an idea, and behind that idea is a story. So I want to show you that story. Again, keep the audience in mind. It's crucial to understanding what side of the story Jesus is speaking to. But I want to show you a story. It is rooted in 1 Kings chapter 10. 1 Kings chapter 10. I hear you turning. It might be helpful to actually see this one. It'll all be on the screen too. You're like, why would I turn to him? You put it on the screen. We're not dumb. I know. 1 Kings chapter 10. The story is about a man named Solomon. Solomon, at this point in the story, is a king. He's the ruler of the Israelites. He's the Jewish king. So God's chosen people way back from the Exodus story, way back before that in the Genesis story. Solomon now is the king of these people. His dad, anybody know who his dad is? David. Okay, so David was the king. David as in David and Goliath. David and Goliath. David was the king, but David has now passed away. David's dead, and Solomon is in charge, and Solomon's going to be met by a visitor, and all kinds of things then happen. So let me read you 1 Kings 10, verse 1. When the queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon and his relationship to the Lord, she came to test Solomon with hard questions. Arriving at Jerusalem with a very great caravan, picture this, with camels carrying spices, large quantities of gold and precious stones, she came to Solomon and talked with him about all that she had on her mind. So there's this queen of Sheba, and this queen of Sheba, by the way, all sorts of fascinating history on the queen of Sheba. It took all the restraint in me not to go there, okay? But you should Google it. But the queen of Sheba, fascinating history behind her, all we need to know for the story is this is a major world player. She is massive on the world stage. She is the leader's leader. She is a larger than life figure. And she's come to Solomon, and you get this sense when you read the story, do you not? You get the sense that she's not quite so sure about Solomon. She comes to test him. She fires questions at him. I imagine the questions are like, okay, hang on a second, Solomon. You say you're a king, but isn't it true that just like 3 or 4 generations ago, your ancestors were slaves? You think you can like sit on the world stage? Isn't it true that your like little kingdom of Israel, like you're basically just a couple generations from being desert wanderers living off of bread in the desert? Like, isn't Solomon, how old are you, Solomon? I know your dad. It sounds like he did some things, but like, seriously, like you think you can be king? The authors tell us that she fires hard questions. She's got this caravan. She's got this power and strength. And so does Solomon flinch? Notice what we read next. Solomon answered all of her questions. Nothing was too hard for the king to explain to her. When the queen of Sheba saw all the wisdom of Solomon and the palace he had built, the food on his table, the seating of his officials, the attending servants in their robes, his cupbearers, and the burnt offerings he made at the temple of the Lord, she was overwhelmed. That always feels good, doesn't it? And it's like, you're the underdog, and it's like, gotcha. She's impressed. She's impressed by Solomon. She has all these hard questions, and guess what? She like tries to Simon Cowell him, like, you are awful, pitchy, whatever. And she fires back at the hard questions. He fires back at her hard questions, and he's got an answer. He's got an answer. He's got an answer. He speaks with the wisdom of a prophet. But not just a prophet. He leads like a king. In fact, like she's like it says here, she marvels at like, okay, even your cupbearers and your royal officials, like everyone's wearing these elaborate robes and they all kind of serve you and they all kind of move. Like Solomon, clearly they respect you. You're like a prophet, but you're also like a king. You're like a strong king. But not just this. Did you catch the detail? He offers the sacrifices, the burnt offerings in the temple to the Lord. That's the job of a priest. Like the priests are the ones who do that. So we have this king who's also like a prophet, but he's also like a priest. He's like a prophet and a priest and a king, all rolled up into one. And we read here that she's impressed. Now, are you surprised? Probably not, right? Like, because we, especially if you grew up in the church, maybe if this is a new story, like, I don't even know what I would be surprised about. But if you didn't grow up in the church, like, maybe you've heard, or if you did grow up in the church, maybe you've heard the stories of Solomon as a young boy. Remember these stories? Solomon, at one point, is approached by God. His dad's still living, but he's going to take over. And he's just a kid. And God comes to him. And essentially says, Solomon, I'll give you whatever you want. What do you want? And a lesser man would have said, I want power, or I want fame, or I want money. Like most kids would say that, right? But Solomon doesn't say that. What does Solomon tell God he wants? Yeah. Let me read you exactly how he says it. He says, God, give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. Dare I say, he's hungering and thirsting for righteousness. How do we do this right? God comes to him and says, I'll give you whatever you want. And what is his response? I just want to be a good man. I just want to be a good leader. God, could you give me the wisdom? Some of the early stories of Solomon are legendary. Some of the cases that he helps to, I mean, they're just like stuff of legend, but like true legend, right? Like they're just epic stuff. And the Queen of Sheba, a couple years later, several years later, she's now brought her caravan, and she's impressed. And then we read this. Verse 6, she said to the king, The report I heard in my own country about your achievements and your wisdom is true. But I did not believe these things, until I came and saw with my own eyes. Indeed, not even half was told me. In wisdom and in wealth, you have far exceeded the report I have heard. And then she says this, how happy your people must be. How blessed your people must be. How happy, how blessed your officials who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. Praise be to the Lord your God. She uses the name of God there, Yahweh. Praise be to the Lord your God who has delighted in you and placed you on the throne of Israel. Because of the Lord's, Yahweh's eternal love for Israel, he has made you king to maintain, and here's the word, justice and righteousness. Jesus will later say, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. As a child, Solomon asked God, God, I just want to be able to discern from right and wrong. And what does the Queen of Sheba say? Solomon, I looked around. You're doing it. You're doing it. Her specific words are, how happy your people must be. Because God surely has put you on the throne to maintain justice and righteousness. These two words, justice and righteousness, in Hebrew are the phrase mishpat and zedekah. Let me hear you say mishpat. Now zedekah. Yeah, mishpat and zedekah. Loaded words in the Hebrew language. Throughout the Old Testament, throughout the Hebrew Bible, these words are coupled together all the time. Essentially, the idea when you look them all up is righteousness and justice, mishpat and zedekah, everything in its right place. The poor are lifted up. The suffering, the hurting, the sick are lifted up. The elderly, because most in this day and age, if you were old, you were a liability. But the elderly, they're lifted up. Those who have no voice, they're given a voice. And the Queen of Sheba says, I know why God put you on the throne, Solomon. You were put on the throne by God himself to maintain justice and righteousness, everything ordered the way it should be. Isn't it true that something in us knows that's true? That the role of a leader, whether you're the leader of a school, a house, a family, whether you're a leader of a business, a church, a government, like we know that the role of a leader is to make sure those who have no voice have a voice, right? And she says, you know what? I know why you were put in power, Solomon. I know why. You were put in power to maintain justice and righteousness. And so she leaves. But before she leaves, she gives all of this stuff to Solomon. I think, and I'm reading between the lines here, but I think she's thinking, her thoughts are, I'm going to leave all this stuff because Solomon, he's got like a good compass. He's got a good moral compass. He's going to spend it on those who are suffering and hurting, and he's going to use this money to maintain justice and righteousness. Notice how he spends the money. Verse 18. Then the king made a great throne covered with ivory and overlaid with fine gold. I almost picture Solomon like, okay, did you guys hear what she said? Like, that's the Queen of Sheba. That's like the Beyonce of the old world. That's the Queen of Sheba. She says, I'm a great king. How come my throne is so, like, not great? I need a better throne. Okay, and I don't want just any throne. I want like a throne with gold on it and ivory. Like those elephants, I want them on my throne. I want gold and ivory on a throne. Essentially what he's doing here is he's elevating himself above the people. Notice what it says next. It says, the throne had six steps and its back had a rounded top. On both sides of the seat were armrests. It's like a lazy boy of all thrones, with a lion standing beside each of them. 12 lions stood on the six steps, one at either end of each step. Because, you know, Detroit. That's probably right. Nothing like it had ever been made for any other kingdom. Do you see what Solomon's doing? He's elevating himself. You're raising up the poor. It's equal. But now all of a sudden you find Solomon saying, oh, but I have this power and I have this money. story goes on. All King Solomon's his goblets, which I believe is a drinking glass, tumblers, if you grew up in a Dutch household. All of Solomon's tumblers were gold, and all the household articles in the palace of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. Nothing was made of silver because silver was considered of little value in Solomon's day. And in case you thought he'd stop there, the king had a fleet of trading ships at sea along with the ships of Hiram. Once every 3 years, it returned carrying gold, silver, and ivory, and apes and baboons. Because that's how you know you've made it. When you have a pet monkey, you name him Bubbles. 23, King Solomon was greater in riches and wisdom than all the other kings of the earth. Now, perhaps you're thinking, like, so what? Like, he's got money. Like, if silver has no value, then apparently the economy is doing pretty good. And as long as the economy is doing great, who cares if the king is, like, skimming some off the side? Like, right? As long as our bottom line is good, as long as I have more in my paycheck this year than last year, who cares if he's got a rounded throne with lions on steps? Let the king have his throne. He works hard. Who cares? The answer to that is a guy by the name of Moses. Now, last week, if you were here, we spent a lot of time on Moses. Moses shows up a couple generations earlier. He preaches a sermon from the side of a mount. Some muscle memory coming. Moses leads the Israelite people out of slavery in Egypt. And then he gives this sermon. And in the sermon, he gives a series of warnings. Like, hey, when you get power, here's what you need to be paying attention to. Be careful for these things. He has some specific warnings for the king. Let me read you what he says to the king. He says, the king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them. For the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. He must not take many wives or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. So when our author tells us that King Solomon was greater in riches and wisdom than all the other kings of the earth, remember, these storytellers, these authors are quite clever and they're quite brave. Like, they don't hold back their punches very quickly. You know really quickly how they feel about the abuse of power. You can sniff it out pretty quickly how they feel about the abundance of wealth that's being mishandled or misplaced. And for instance, a very not so subtle, like, seriously, verse 14. The weight of the gold that Solomon received yearly, they make sure to tell you this, the weight of the gold that Solomon received yearly was 666 talents. Subtle much? 666. And then it'll go on to say, oh yeah, there was other gold too, but I'm going to tell you about this particular gold because I need you to know that the weight of this gold, someone counted, was 666 talents. Now, if you find a conversion chart, that is about 25 tons of gold. There's a lot of gold there, but don't miss, like, the not so subtle condemnation on Solomon. What are these authors saying? What is 666? Throughout the Bible, 666 is a number for anti-justice, anti-righteousness, anti-God. Solomon, you are accumulating this gold, but you're not working with God or for God. You are now working against God. And notice what he spends his money on, verse 26. I know I'm leaping around if you're following along, but we're trying to save some time for some numbers. So, verse 26, Solomon accumulated chariots and horses. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horses, which he kept in the chariot cities and also with him in Jerusalem. What does Moses say? Hey, when you have a king, be careful because your king is going to want to accumulate certain things. What does he warn them not to ever accumulate? Horses. Oh, and by the way, horses and chariots. What's a horse and chariot? It's a weapon, right? Like, this is pre-tanks. This is an ancient tank. Solomon is stockpiling tanks. Moses says, don't you stockpile tanks. Don't deal in that. But Solomon's stockpiling tanks. The last time we encountered tanks in the Bible, our horses and chariots, Pharaoh was riding around on a horse and chariot chasing the Israelites in the desert. Speaking of Pharaoh, verse 28, Solomon's horses were imported from where? What did Moses say? Just don't do this. Like, Egypt. They used to beat your great-great-grandparents. They used to put chains on you. The language in Exodus is they worked you ruthlessly. Don't become trade partners with them. They're evil. Don't you go back there, God says, Moses says in Deuteronomy. But then also catch this, verse 29. So he's importing horses. They also exported them to all the kings of the Hittites and of the Aramaeans. Now, if horses and chariots are weapons, see if you can follow this, if they are weapons, and Solomon is importing them, and he is exporting them, what is Solomon becoming? He's becoming an arms dealer. Now, again, the storytellers aren't neutral, in case that's not been clear yet. They're not neutral about how they feel about all this. They don't do the government's got to protect the rights. They don't do that game. They just say it's wrong. It's wrong. Our job, government's got its job, but our job as like the storytellers, our job as the prophets later, our job is to call out wrong when we see wrong, and so they don't hold their punches. Essentially what they say is, you know what, Solomon? We see you. You may have fooled the Queen of Sheba. She may have left here thinking you've got it all together, but you haven't fooled us. You may be above the law of the land, but we know what Moses told us on that mountain, and you are not above the law of God, and we will call it out. Now, flip back a page. I want to show you one more thing, and then we'll try to make a couple connections. One more page. To chapter 9. Now, again, remember, one of the things the Queen of Sheba is most impressed by in Solomon's buildings is Solomon builds a temple to God. He builds the original temple. Herod then will come in and make it bigger and better, but he builds the original great temple. And so she says, how happy your people must be because you've been put on the throne to maintain justice and righteousness. How happy your people must be. Again, our storytellers know what they're doing. I'm not so sure. Look at verse 15. Notice how the temple has been built. Here's the account of the forced labor King Solomon conscripted to build the Lord's temple, his own palace, the terraces, the wall of Jerusalem, and Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. Yeah. Uh-oh. By the way, what's another word for forced labor? Slaves. You catch what's going on here? Solomon is building a temple to the God who has rescued his people from slavery using slaves. See how backwards that is. Solomon is building a temple to the God who says again and again, remember you were slaves in Egypt and how I rescued you. Again and again, remember you were slaves and I rescued you. Solomon's building a place where people can go and worship. He's offering sacrifices. He's doing the religious game, but he's doing it using slaves. What do the authors want us to see? There's a new Pharaoh in town and his name is Solomon. And yes, he is our king, but he's not doing his job. His job is to maintain justice and righteousness, to lift the low, to make sure everyone has a voice. And the authors are like, it's just not happening. Okay, I got a little bit of time. We are told about three cities mentioned here, Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. Let me show you them on a map. If you notice, Hazor's in the north, Megiddo's right outside of Caesarea, which is a major city built by Caesar, and then Gezer is in the south of Israel. Any guesses as to what Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer are? military bases. Circle them in your Bible. Those are military strongholds. Because when you are building an empire, when you are accumulating stuff, you have to protect that stuff. Now, there's nothing wrong with protecting stuff, right? Hear me clearly. There's nothing wrong with I have little children too. Okay? There's nothing wrong with protecting your land. There's nothing wrong with it. But just notice Solomon is building military bases. Nothing wrong with it unless your stuff is more valuable than your people, which is what you discover here is there's some political compromises going on. You catch this? Like, I need to protect our stuff. I need to protect our land. I got gold goblet tumblers that I drink out of, and they're gold. I need to protect it. And so I need to use slaves to build the cities that will protect the gold. That's backwards. Now, notice what comes next in that same passage. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had attacked and captured Gezer. He set it on fire. Pause. Pharaoh, good guy or bad guy in the story? Bad guy. It's not the same Pharaoh that chased the Israelites. That was a couple hundred years ago. It's not that same Pharaoh, but this new Pharaoh, also not a good guy. Unpause. He killed its Canaanite inhabitants and then gave it as a wedding gift to his daughter, Solomon's wife. This is like right out of the Bible. Solomon marries whose daughter? A couple hundred years earlier, they were beating your ancestors, and now you're saying, but this is good for politics. Like, if we're allied with Egypt, Egypt's got like all these horses, and we've got all these things, and we can import from them, and we can export to them, and we can kind of be centralized in the trade route. This is really good news for business. So I'm going to marry Pharaoh's daughter. We're going to ally our two countries because they're not going to attack us if I'm married to the daughter. What does Moses whisper from like the ancient words from the side of a mountain? Don't do it. It will all fall apart on you. And sure enough, it should not surprise us. Chapter 11, one chapter after the Queen of Sheba's story, we read that Solomon, verse 3, he had 700 wives of royal birth. So apparently he's doing this with a lot of foreign empires. I'm politically allying with all of you. 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. What did Solomon warn would happen? It's going to happen this way. Since this is your attitude, verse 11, since this is your attitude, God says, you have not kept my covenant and my decrees, which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you. And he does. The next, Solomon will die. It tells a story if you keep reading, but there's a civil war that happens. The North and the South rebel against each other. It's a bloodbath. And then a bunch of foreign nations come in and they destroy and they destroy and they destroy. And it's just a massacre. The Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Persians and the Greeks and then the Romans. But what do our storytellers want us to hear? Don't blame the Assyrians, the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans. This thing died inside before anyone else attacked it. This thing crumbled from the inside. They just finished it off. This country lost its plot. They lost their way. The king lost the mission. How happy the people must be. No. This king messed it up. And so, of course, it's a warning. There's this psalm. It's one of my favorite psalms. It's Psalm 27. It's 20, verse 7. It says this: some trust in chariots. This is penned by Solomon's dad. Some trust in chariots and horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. Some trust in chariots and horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. Solomon forgot that. He puts his trust in his tanks and bombs and trucks and stuff, and it all falls apart. Now, how you doing? It's a tough story. What do we do with that? Let me give a couple statistics, because here's what can easily happen when we read stories like this. Two things I notice in myself when I read a story like this. The first is I can easily say, well, that is just an old ancient Bible story, and, you know, cool, it happened then, but like, fun to learn about, but how is this relevant to me today? That happens. The other thing that's really easy, this is easier for me to do, is it's really easy for me to villainize someone like Solomon. He's the bad guy, right? We're the good guys. He's the bad guy. And I think in doing so, and don't hear me directly connecting us and them. I'm honestly not trying to do that. But I think what we miss in the story is this story is a warning. That's why I love history. It's why I went into history, because if we pay attention to history, we hear the warnings. And this story is a warning. Now, we are told two things. We're told a couple of things about Solomon, but two big things. One is he's really wealthy. And the other thing we're told about Solomon is he accumulated a giant, massive military power. So wealth and power. Let me give you a few stats. And these are just numbers. I really don't have a giant agenda with these numbers. I just think that awareness is probably helpful. So let me just give you a couple numbers and then a couple of thoughts on those numbers. First number. There are currently 195 nations in our world. 195 currently. One of them is the United States of America. So we are one of 195. We are one of the youngest nations in the world. We're what, 240? Someone do the math. We're one of the youngest nations in our world. Roughly 4% of the world's population. So when you take these 195 countries, we are pretty young on the world stage. We are also, so you see how this kind of connects to the story? We are also about 4% of the world's population. So we're not, like, I think India is like 17%, so where Tom is, like, you see all the cars. Like, we are roughly 4% of the world's population, and yet we make up some of the greatest wealth in our world. The median household income, according to the last census in our nation, now some are higher than this, some are lower than this, but the median household income in our nation is just shy of $60,000 a year. So that breaks down to roughly $165 a day. Now, if you're trying to raise a family, that's not a ton of money to raise a family off of, pay house, mortgage, car, all that, but $165 a day. Now, to put that number into perspective, 80% of our world lives on less than $10 a day. Let's think about that. 80%, so you got to make the cuts. Like, okay, I guess Starbucks is gone, and I guess Target, I probably shouldn't just go there because I always spend money there. And like, so you make some of the cuts. One-third, more than a third of our world lives on less than $2 a day. Again, remember Jesus' audience. The system isn't working for us. It was those 2% or third. So we may not be drinking out of goblets made of gold, but by the world standards, would you agree that you and I are wealthy? Okay. Now, our country is run by a government. This is like civics 101. Our country is run by a government, and the way a government is funded is through your taxes. Everyone's favorite thing to do is pay taxes. Now, in our taxes, there's a couple of like big like things that our money goes to in taxes. A lot of the social programs, police, all this stuff. One of the biggest areas that our tax money goes to is the Pentagon. The Pentagon is responsible for our defense. Last year, roughly $800 billion was spent on defense. The second largest defense budget in the world, so we're number one, the second largest defense budget in the world is, any guesses? Russia. Russia spends roughly $76 billion on the defense. So U.S. number one at $800 billion, Russia number two at $76 billion. And then if you just take all the next 10, including Russia, the U.S. spends more on our defense than the next 10 countries combined. Now, again, don't hear me making a statement on this. I think our defense, like, I love the protection we have as well. I just want to call out, we spend the money here. Okay, a couple more statistics. I know, I told you it's going to be fun. Now, first, a statistic on nuclear weapons. Right now, there are 9 countries out of 195 countries on our planet that have nuclear weapons. 9 countries. The big threats, if you watch the news, is that new countries, especially not such great countries, might possess nuclear weapons in our near future. And so this is why all of the money we spend is because there might be some other countries who may not use the weapons right, would get them. But there's 9 right now that have them. The estimates are that it would take about 100 nuclear bombs to go off before life on planet Earth would be inhabitable. So if 100 nuclear bombs, it erodes like the climate, ozone, whatever, and we can't live here anymore. Again, these are just the numbers, 100 nuclear bombs. 93% of the nuclear bombs of the 9 countries that have nuclear bombs are owned between 2 countries. Us and, any guesses on the second one? Russia. Well done. Now, the U.S. alone possesses 7,300 nuclear bombs. It would take 100 nuclear bombs. That's actually probably a conservative estimate. But it would take about 100 nuclear bombs for no more civilization on planet Earth. We possess 7,300 nuclear bombs. Now, one more number. There is a lot of more numbers we could talk about, but for the sake of this story, one more number. I want us to see that the line between us and Solomon isn't fuzzy. Okay, so I just want us to see, like, hey, if we are in this story, and there's a warning that God needs us to hear in the story, but it's not always a fun warning, especially if you're sitting up here. So, most nations who have militaries have military bases: Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. The military bases. These military bases play an important function in a country. Our military bases are, like, essentially, and why most countries have them, is to protect the stuff, our stuff. And more than our stuff, is to, at their best, you may disagree on this, but I would say job number one of a government is to protect its citizens. And so most countries have military bases. Some countries, not many, but some countries have military bases on foreign soils, in other countries. So, for instance, Russia has, any guesses how many they have? 6. So, oh, I'm sorry, 8. 8 military bases in other countries, at least that we know of. Great Britain has 7, and France has 5 in other countries. The United States has some military bases in other countries. Any guesses on that number? 662 military bases in other countries. And again, that's a conservative estimate. Someone put that number closer to 800, although I think probably the conservative number is probably right there. 662. Now, here's why I share the numbers. Honestly, I am not trying to make political statements here. I'm sharing the numbers because whether or not we are comfortable admitting it, we are living in an empire. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Again, the Queen of Sheba visits the empire and says, oh, this empire is a good empire because you're here to protect justice and righteousness. You're here to make sure everyone has a voice. There's nothing wrong with defense, empire, any of these things. But the warning, so what's easy is to align ourselves with the people sitting on the hill in the Beatitudes who have been stepped on and stepped on and stepped on. But we're actually, like, if we are an empire, the warning that we need to listen to is probably the warnings that come to empires. The question at the heart of any empire is, what do you do with your power, privilege, and your weapons? What do we do with, do we use whatever we have to protect those most vulnerable, the last, the least, and the lowest? Do we use our power to raise up those who have lost their voice, who have been robbed of their voice? Or do we use our power to make sure they never get a voice? There's a warning in the scriptures. The warning in the scriptures is, if we become so obsessed with profiting off of more weapons, more missiles, more drones, more bombs, if we become obsessed with it, we may forget the cry of an entire group of people who are saying, the system isn't working for us. I think what you hear now in our world, in our country, is the voice of those who are from the margins crying out like, hey, don't forget us in this thing. Now, the church has often at our best, and even in, right now in our current climate, at our best, the church has said, we hear you and we will make sure others are listening. The church at its best has been the ones to advocate for. Now, we don't know all the details. We're not sure that necessarily your agenda is, we don't know the details, but we're listening for your voice, because to shut your voice out of our lives means we may miss the voice of Jesus who's trying to speak through your lips. So at our best, the church has done really great that. At our worst, we have created systems where we've kept those voices from having a voice. Now, Matthew begins his gospel, story of Jesus, his gospel, by telling us that there's a new son of David on the scene. Why does Matthew need to tell us that there's a new son of David on the scene? Because the last son of David, Solomon, lost the plot. And Jesus comes in and he begins, that's why we start where we start, by looking at the audience. I see you, I see you. It's not working. I see you, desperate, hungry, and thirsty. I see you, I see you. But then, if you read the rest of what Jesus says in the brilliant Sermon on the Mount, what is the sermon to these people? So here's the thing. You've been pushed down. There's enough of you now that have been pushed down. You could push back. You could punch back. You could fight back. You realize this, right? There's enough of you. Like, the problem is when power gets exploited enough, it eventually becomes revolution, because that group of people who's pushed down gets larger and larger and rises up. You could push back. You could fight back. Don't. Turn the other cheek. Don't trade violence for violence. There's a myth behind the whole machine of Rome, the whole machine of Solomon and his time, and potentially a myth that we continue to buy into, and it's the myth of redemptive violence. The idea that if you're violent to me, the only way to stop your violence is by being more violent back. And Jesus says, no, it's just not true. You want to know what works. It's like a mustard seed. Like, enough of you start doing acts, small acts, just little things filled with great love. That's what changes the world. You know what works is small acts. No, that's not saying that there's not a role of the government. I'll leave the people who have make more money and whatever. I'll let them make those decisions. What I'm saying is, when the church is at its best, we have got the priorities right. Let me end with one last thing, some good news, because that's what we do, right? It's easy to listen to numbers and statistics and a story that's a heavy story. It's easy to listen to the stuff like that and to immediately get defensive or cynical. It's easy, right? Defensive or cynical or jaded, depending on where you stand in all this stuff. Like, it's easy to become one of those three things. But listen, as Christians, we don't do defensiveness. We don't do cynicism. We do gospel. We do hope. And there is a message of hope in here. Here's the message of hope. And I think we see it all over the place. When the church gets this right, let me just speak to you. When you all get this right, and I see it all the time, it actually does change things. Statistics, studies have been done on Kids Hope, a mentoring program that our church is part of. And it has looked at Kids Hope and has taken Kids Hope and has said, I wonder what happens when Kids Hope moves into a city. And then years later, when those kids become adults, I wonder what happens to things like crime in that city. I wonder what happens to things like poverty in that city. What we discover is that Kids Hope, an hour a week, sitting with a kid, trying to pretend like you know how to do the math that they don't know how to do either. Like, that hour a week, that investment into that child actually changes things. Hand to hand, feeding kids that are hungry. Turns out, hungry kids do mean things. Just feeding them. And so instead of saying, like, we got to lock all those kids. No, just feeding them actually changes their lives. And the good news is, we do this. Starlight Shores, taking care of kids who have like literally their life is lived in hospital bed after hospital bed, like saying to them, we love you, actually changes things. Right now, We've got a pastor who, Tanner Smith, do you know Tanner? Tanner just started working with Partners Relief and Development. He's literally going behind the Iraqi forces as they take ground with ISIS, and he's one of the team people who are helping the victims of ISIS come running out, and like he's providing them with water and kerosene and hope. And it changes things. I see when the church gets it right, when we do this well, like the world actually says, oh, that's what Jesus is about. That's what he stands for. When we get it wrong, we find ourselves like arguing about which chariots are best or how many chariots we should be using. But the psalmist says some trust in chariots and horses. Some can argue about that because that's where they put their hope, but not you. We trust in God. And so that's where we put our energy and our hope. And that is good news because he can be trusted. Lord, I pray this with deep love for this room and these people. Lord, I pray that you would continue to search our own hearts where we have become addicted or obsessed with violence, where we have bought the lie that more violence is actually going to bring more protection. Lord, I pray that you would speak to the deep parts of us that have bought that lie. Lord, help us to distinguish between right and wrong. Help us to discern between right and wrong. Help us to discern how to protect ourselves. Lord, I don't know how to do that. Lord, but also help us to trust you more. Lord, help us to trust you, the God of the universe, that you actually know what you're talking about. That when you say eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, no, that's wrong. Lord, help us to trust that you actually knew what you were talking about. Lord, help us to not offer the sacrifices to you one day and then on the next day turn our backs on you and just go our own way. Lord, help us to trust you. And Lord, as we sing this next song, which is difficult words to actually live out, Lord, would you help us to have the strength even to do that. Jesus, we love you, we thank you, and we pray this in your name. And everybody said, would you please stand?